Welcome, old friends, and I see quite a few new faces maybe here for the first time. Welcome tonight on the eve of Rohatsu Sesshin. This is our annual 7-day retreat to celebrate the Buddha's awakening. We begin tomorrow morning, and all of you are most welcome to drop in and sit. There'll be a schedule posted, and we'll be sitting zazen and doing walking meditation, and there'll be Dharma talks from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. Up to next Wednesday evening. And some people are doing whole days with meals in the Zendo, but the schedule's open to all of you to come in and join this retreat. And as a kind of encouragement to begin this sesshin, there's a story tonight. This is case 39 in the Book of Serenity called Jiaozhou's Wash Your Bowl. A classic Zen story. So if some of you are brand new to Zen practice, this is the best story. Everything you need to know is in the story. These old koan stories from many centuries ago in China usually begin with an introduction. So the poetic introduction to the story goes like this. When food comes, you open your mouth. When sleep comes, you close your eyes. As you wash your face, you find your nose. When you take off your shoes, you feel your feet. At that time, if you miss what's being said here, take a torch and make a special search deep in the night. How can you realize unity? That's the introduction to get in the mood for this story. The story goes like this. A monk asked Jiaozhou, the Zen teacher Jiaozhou, I have just entered this temple. Please give me some guidance. Jiaozhou said, Have you had breakfast yet? The monk said, Yes, I've eaten. And Jiaozhou said, Well then, go wash your bowl. So we could stop here, or, you know, since this talk is scheduled to go on a little bit longer, we could talk some too. But pretty straightforward. Jiaozhou was one of our really great ancestors. A lot of these old Zen stories are about him. And a very kind of straightforward manner of teaching. And also a very inspired and humble practitioner. He began Zen practice when he was 60 years old.
66 old?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, quite like late in life, yeah. Met a teacher, Nan Chuan. I can't remember exactly when he started, but he practiced devotedly with his teacher till his teacher died, and at that time Jiaozhou was already 80 years old. and he could have just retired, but instead he decided to go on pilgrimage and meet other Zen teachers. So he traveled around the country, and with this vow, when he set off to travel around and meet teachers, he said, if there's even a young child who has some wisdom to impart to me, I will just be happy to listen to his teaching or her teaching. And if there's a great seasoned practitioner who could use a little more teaching, I'm happy to give them teaching. So in this way, he would meet others. And finally, he settled down in a temple and taught till he was 120 years old, as the story goes. So this story is classically seen in almost like two different ways. One of them is just exactly how it sounds, couldn't be more straightforward. I've just entered the monastery, the temple. Please give me some guidance. Please offer me some instruction how to practice here. And Jiaozhe said, have you had breakfast yet? The monk said, yes, I have. Jiaozhe said, well, then wash your bowl. So just what do you do when you're done with breakfast? You wash the dishes. Just do the next thing, the appropriate, simple next thing. And I think in this way, it's a nice inspiration for this week of retreat. Not only will we being served food in our bowls in the Zendo, but washing water will be brought in, and we can wash them here, which is actually the best way to practice after we finish breakfast, is to wash our bowls. And thus the day goes. In a Zen sesshin, in a Zen retreat, the whole day is like that. The bell rings and you get up from zazen and you do walking meditation. Another bell rings and we sit back down. Another bell rings and we get up and chant. Another bell rings and we sit down and have breakfast. And then we wash our bowls and then do it all again. And, you know, outside of Zen retreat, our life is like this too. Can we just do the next thing in this moment when it arises and drop away the previous thing, to just live like this without getting too involved in what happened before, like that delicious breakfast, or what's going to happen next, like the break after the meal, but just wash the bowl. That's the most straightforward way to see this. But another classic interpretation is often these Zen stories are a little bit more like they're talking sort of in metaphors or poetically about Zen practice. So, have you had breakfast yet? Have you eaten your fill? Do you have some taste of the Tathagata's teaching? Do you have some experience of reality through this practice? The teacher asks the arriving monk. Yes, I've had breakfast. Like, I have had some taste of the teaching, actually. So there. In this case, the monk is asking for further guidance. Do you have any guidance? First, the Jiaozhe checks. Well, do you actually have some taste of truth from your Zen practice so far? Yes, I have. Then the instruction is wash your bowl. In other words, forget about that now and hang up your sandals in the monk's hall and take your cushion and start sitting zazen until the bell rings, and then have breakfast or lunch. So not dwelling in the past, particularly some kind of enlightened past. It's usually interpreted as have you eaten means like I've eaten my fill of like the good stuff, that I've tasted some truth. And then the admonition is, okay, forget about that now. And because that was then and this is now. In this way, Jiaozhou often taught this kind of way. In another story later in this collection, Case 57, another seasoned practitioner came to Jiaozhou and said, when not a single thing is brought, then what? And Jiaozhou said, put it down. And this practitioner said, well, if I don't bring a single thing, what can I put down? And Jiaozhou said, well, then carry it out. So this is kind of the way he was. And I think it's a very similar story to this one. Have you had breakfast? Then wash your bowl. Like, don't hold on to any past great experiences you've had, because if you do, you'll miss this one. One 19th century lay practitioner named Teshu said, Zen is like soap. First you wash with it, then you wash off the soap. So that's the instruction if we're nice and soapy with Zen soap. So again, usually it's spoken of like this. Have you had some experience? Like Jimi Hendrix says, are you experienced? And usually it's meant like a very sweet experience. But thinking about this story today, I think, well, it also applies to not so nice experiences. Basically, have you had any experience? Like, have you had a really painful experience? Did you have an awful breakfast this morning? Yes, I had an awful experience of breakfast this morning. Well, then wash your bowl. So I think it applies nicely here, because in fact, often what we're trying to practice with, we don't have that much difficulty letting go of enlightenment experiences, right? We might, maybe in a retreat, well, we can work with that, but might say, well, that's not my problem. My problem is washing out these painful experiences from the past. It's all about the past in either case. Yes, I have eaten. I've already eaten. And the instruction is, well then, wash out that bowl that has some residue on it. That bowl is like our mind, you could say, our experiencing mind. And particularly, some of us recently have been studying some of the Indian Buddhist teachings about the storehouse consciousness, it's called, which is like what makes each of us unique in this model of teaching. The storehouse consciousness is like every time we do any intentional activity, it kind of plants a seed in the storehouse, and then the seeds are in that ground of consciousness, and when they're watered by other events in our life, they sprout and they come to fruition as a new experience that's, you know, related to the seed that was planted. So it's a storehouse of karmic tendencies and our habitual responses to things. This is the storehouse consciousness. So tonight maybe we could call it the bowl consciousness. Have you eaten? Have you had an experience in your bowl called breakfast? Yes, I have. Well, you've finished eating that experience, but the experience has left some residue in your bowl consciousness, right? So the instruction is not to wash our bowl. Isn't it true that our experiences seem to leave this residue in our consciousness, whether we call it the storehouse or the bowl consciousness? It's the there's something left over. Really, the Buddha teaches from everything that we do kind of leaves something left over, and it's unconscious. This storehouse consciousness is unconscious. We can't see how all these seeds are laying under the ground here, but we see them when they sprout. So how do we wash the storehouse consciousness? How do we wash our bowl? Yeah. One way would be to wash it in the ocean water of now. Because the residue that's on the bowl, the breakfast remains, are some kind of past events. And I think we're often bound by past events. Sometimes future too, right? We can get obsessed about the future. But I think maybe more often it's the past. Like when people come to talk to me about their practice, it's often about the past, more often than about the future. And the future is more often than about the present. In a way, we're always talking about the present. But the content of our present expression is often about the past and how do we work with the past and our regrets about the past, our grudges about the past, our pride about the past, our shame about the past. And so washing this residue in the ocean of now, the healing ocean of now, is so purifying. So some past, very difficult, painful experience of the past, we can let it be in the present, because actually there, from a deeper perspective, there really isn't a past or a future. And I would say there's not even really a present moment, a moment being like an interval between two other moments in a long stream of moments. That's one way of talking and thinking about time. But I would say in our most direct experience, there's only now, and now not being a moment in time, but now being like the eternal now, the ever-present now, the unchanging now, that that takes the form of this seeming stream of events that we call past and future. But truly, it's impossible to experience anything other than now, is it not? And is now not the same now as a moment ago? And not the same now as yesterday? And not the same now as the day we were born? And not the same now as before our parents were born? I mean, experientially. Isn't there always now? And these are ways of talking, but I think our more common way of talking, our more common model is that time is the series of moments that arise and cease. Conventionally speaking, I think that's okay, you know. And the Buddha would even speak that way conventionally. But I think a more deeper, direct, experiential way of being is just that we are always now. Which is not a time, not a particular time. It's timeless now. Just like the here where we are might be a particular point in space. Like a moment is a particular point in time. But I'm proposing that really now is not a particular point in time. It's all-inclusive, ever-present now. And same with here, it's a particular point in space, is not exactly our direct experience. Seems to me our direct experience is like always here. Here that includes all space, just like now includes all time. Now includes all moments, space, and here includes all locations that we can possibly experience, right? I mean, if we're looking over there somewhere, actually, for us it's here. And if there's some abstract there that we're not experiencing, we can't really say anything about it except speculation. We are always here, and we are always now. And actually, that's not a particular time or a particular place. So in this way, this is what we can wash our bowl in, is this eternal now and this eternal here. Our residue of past joyful events, but particularly, I think, past painful breakfasts. We can bring them into the present and hold them in the present where they are, actually. And rather than thinking, regretting, for example, that when I served that person breakfast this morning, I didn't serve it to them so nicely. And I think they were a little upset with me because the breakfast I served them, I didn't serve it so nicely, and I didn't offer them any condiments or anything. And I kind of regret that now. Now I regret it. Now I regret this past breakfast serving from this morning. But in fact, that past breakfast serving is now. Right? So in this sense, if we're really present, regret starts to seem like a strange thing, because regret is usually about some past thing. So it's more like this event of serving someone breakfast in not such a nice way. I actually, right now, I serve it to them as I would like to, fully, right now. And in a way, that's just as real as the so-called memory of serving them in not such a nice way. Maybe that's kind of strange to consider, but both of them are now, and both of them are just created by our intention. We can bring the past into the present and include it as part of the all-inclusiveness of the present, and see its nature as this presence. And then we have a different relationship with it. We are it. Even something really painful from the past is more like just part of the flavor of this vast and inconceivable presence. I think this is healing, to bring past pain into the ocean of now like this. And also, the quicker we do it, the easier it is. Like if we let the residue stay on the bowl and dry there, it's harder, it takes longer to wash it, doesn't it? And also, I've noticed that different breakfast cereals are, especially after they dry, are easier to wash than others. Like oatmeal is somewhat, has a kind of slippery texture. So even when it's like, gets really crusted on, and I confess that after breakfast, I usually do not wash my bowls right away. I do it in Sashin because they bring the water in, so it's easy. But usual breakfast, I have breakfast and then I kind of like, I often start reading or something and I kind of just don't bother getting up to bring the bowls down to the kitchen. And they get kind of crusty. So, I don't know if I regret that practice. Not so much, really. But I regret it a little bit when it's not oatmeal. Because like I say, oatmeal, you can soak it a little bit and it slides off pretty easily. But cornmeal, has anyone ever let polenta cornmeal dry on their cereal bowl? It's like solid rock. You can't like chip it off with a screwdriver. I mean, it's amazing to me how hard that cereal sticks when you don't wash your bowl, when it's cornmeal especially. And but even then, it's totally dried and crusty. You just let it soak. It takes a little bit longer to soak in the now water. But if you do let it soak, then naturally it starts loosening up. And sometimes if I'm impatient, I'm like, well, I actually am here in the kitchen now. I want to wash the bowl, like, right now, even though it hasn't been soaking. And I'll scrub and scrub with one of these scrubbies. And it usually doesn't work. I might even get out a screwdriver, a chisel. So instead of trying to this, I'm going to do it now in this rough way, in this, like, just chip it out, chip out the past. No, actually, it works better. Just let the bowl soak. Maybe even use some Zen soap. But isn't it interesting that the more we let the residue, the longer we leave the residue on the bowl, the longer it takes to wash. You can always wash it, but if some painful experience happens and we don't wash it, it means like we don't bring it into the present and just include it in the expanse of presence, then we kind of let it be this past thing and try to just like, you know, read the book and think that the dishes might wash themselves. It's harder. It doesn't go away. They don't wash themselves, right? We got to bring it down there and put it in the water. So memories. I think that this storehouse consciousness is one way of our Buddhist ancestors came up with to describe how memory works. Because before they came up with this idea of the storehouse consciousness, it was harder to understand how consciousness is just a moment-to-moment arising and ceasing. How does memory get held? Or how do these karmic tendencies get held? So I think it was a brilliant dharmic invention, this model of the storehouse that in a way holds memories. It's not some thing, and the Buddha actually warned. He said, don't start thinking that this storehouse consciousness is like your true self, and it's this entity that's storing up like a hard drive, all of this stuff. We don't have a hard drive, according to the Buddha. We just have like an ocean of ever-changing karmic patterns, and this ever-changing container of karmic patterns and memories is the storehouse. So part of the story is that is that for Buddhas, they, I think what they're doing is they're washing their bowl very regularly, all these past experiences. They keep bringing them into the present and let them almost like work themselves out in the present. It kind of release themselves into the ocean of presence. And and when they do that, new seeds aren't planted in the same way. In other words, they don't necessarily react in the same reactive way when a seed arises. A seed comes to fruition of a past memory or something. Somebody talked to me like this in the past. My mom talked to me like this in the past. So that seed was planted when she talked to me like that. Now it something waters it in the present and it comes to fruition. And now this person who's not my mom unconsciously reminds me of my mom talking to me like that, so I get annoyed at her. But if we're really present with this whole thing, we can see the patterning. We don't exactly see that it's because of our mom necessarily, but we see like, well, I'm reacting in a strange way to this situation that's not really that bad, actually. I wonder what this is about. And instead of just reacting the way I did to my mom, which kind of plants a very similar seed, the bodhisattvas on the path, don't plant that same kind of seed again. So the storehouse of seeds starts evolving and transforming. And eventually, no new negative karmic seeds are planted. All the past traumatic seeds have come to fruition. And they say, the story here is that the storehouse consciousness disappears. It's no longer a storehouse consciousness. Buddhas do not have a storehouse consciousness. And then the story then, which probably came from people asking, well then what do they have? How do they deal? How do they function in the world without a storehouse consciousness? The story is the transformation of the storehouse consciousness reveals itself to actually be what's called the great perfect mirror awareness. It's no longer a consciousness. It's no longer a divided knowing. It's a boundless awareness called the great perfect mirror awareness, which is a little bit, not even a little bit, I would say, this is the ocean of now. So before we even fully reveal the perfect mirror wisdom, I would say that's how we're practicing with our dirty bowl. We're washing it in the ocean of nowness, which is just like a mirror that just, instead of planting seeds, it just reflects what's happening equally through everything. And nothing sticks to it because it's just like images on a mirror. And so by like little bits of bringing up this mirror, because we all have this mirror, we are this mirror, really. It's when the mirror is tarnished or obscured, we call it the storehouse consciousness. This is a story that can be told. So in the end, when all the seeds are gone, this field that we used to call the storehouse consciousness is now just the perfect mirror awareness of now, of the all-inclusive here and now. And then painful events arise and pleasant events arise, and they're all equally reflected. And our response is now a beneficial response instead of a habitual unconscious reaction. It's a nice story. I like it. Therefore, my liking of that story plants a seed in my somewhat tarnished mirror that I still call a storehouse consciousness. And now you have that seed in your storehouse consciousness. May that be a may that be a beautiful seed that could come to fruition as remembering such a story. That's another story that the Buddhas tell. They say, one story is, people ask, well, how can this, all the seeds of unconscious habit patterns keep getting planted and sprouting and getting planted? How does this mess of, this unconscious mess of kind of, you know, self-centered habits, how does that ever evolve into the perfect mirror awareness? One story is that they say a seed is planted from the realm of reality, the pure realm of reality. Like a Buddha seed gets planted in the storehouse consciousness. And then that, and maybe more than one. So that then now it's evolving in this, according to Dharma. Still there's a bunch of patterns, but the Dharma is in there too now. So it's evolved. Still negative things are happening. We're still reinforcing old habits, but the Dharma is also reinforcing truth in the storehouse at the same time. And whatever's happening, we can just keep washing the bowl. Questions? Yes.
My analogy for me always goes to music and the idea of what is mastery or what is or if you talk about spontaneity before you've talked about practice, there's possible danger.
Yes, uh-huh. Even in the commentaries about this story, they mention that very point. So maybe you're channeling the ancestors. I think this particular story, they mention that point. Can you imagine why?
Yes. I struggle with that.
Mm-hmm. Because it's such an, in a way, it's such an easy story. I think is part of why.
In other words.
Maybe the second part of the story wasn't so easy, right? But just, have you had breakfast, wash your bowl, that part.
Yeah,
it's pretty easy.
And if we're talking, that might be like a teacher telling a musician, that a student, don't think at all about your playing, just play.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only be said to a person who's done their 10,000 hours of practice. Hmm. Because if they haven't done that hard work of just practical, you know, working on technique, that's not good advice. That's bad advice.
Mm, yeah.
You know, it won't help.
It won't sound very nice here.
Well, for me,
it's like doing improv before you learn scales.
Yeah, no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It will confuse them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what they should be working
on. Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. For me, it's like, well, I still feel, oh, I wish I could just do that. Just forget everything. Just let it all just go because I have such a toolkit. You know, practice goes down. But I haven't, you know. So when I think about letting go past hurts, and I think of them a lot of times as being more than just, I sometimes think they're somatic.
Yeah. Well,
really,
yeah.
Really in that,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to take something, if you're too subtle in the way that you say, just bring it into the present, which is powerful medicine,
mm-hmm.
but maybe it's really advanced in a way that it might not help certain people. So I'm only saying, sometimes like, well, what are just some really simpler, maybe, but technical ideas about
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We could get simpler. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I would say, first of all, though, that any of the other methods we might use to work with painful past, they could all be done, at least with the intention, to be working with them in the ocean of now. And it might be that the ocean of now is enough, but it might not be. And if not, then I think another one that, because like you say, it's often somatic, which I think still fits nicely with the cereal residue on the bowl, is this physical thing that is, you can't even chisel it, right? So it's not just an idea or a story. It's, but what I think of as really painful emotions, I think of as a combination of physical sensation and a conceptual story. So it's somatic, and it's a physical sensation, but it's not just that. I think when people say that they have trauma, I think it's not just like a rant, maybe occasionally, but it's usually, I think, not just this random feeling that's totally not connected with any story. It usually is very woven together with the story. And I think usually this, if it's a painful story, it's almost always woven together with a painful physical bodily sensation. So I think one way to work with it, ideally in the ocean of now, is to separate the physical feeling from the conceptual story. Not get rid of either one, but to they're like a ball of tangled yarn, to try to just see how they're not the same thing, because when they're together, they're very, very powerful combination that's going to keep coming up like that. So separating, you might say, well, what do you mean? How could we separate? I think the main way in Zen practice is you focus on the physical, somatic part. You get like, here's this really painful story and I'm feeling so tense about it. Like, put the energy into the physical bodily tightness or somewhere in the body we're holding this. Put our attention there, which doesn't mean that the story goes away, but the story is a little bit more background. And I think that does, in a way, it's what I call separate them a little bit. And then each one of them on its own is somewhat workable. But when they're tangled together like a ball of yarn, it's almost unworkable. So, and of course, the somatic feeling of the painful tightness in the body is happening in the ocean of now. And that's how we wash it, actually, that feeling is. We're attending to it now. We're not trying to remember how it was during this traumatic time. Like, let's try to relive that. No. We have enough right now. This one we feel now. And love that, nurture that, hold that feeling, and then attend to it, and it starts to relax. And then when that starts to get a little more relaxed, then maybe we can shift over to the conceptual story. Although I think that's often, maybe that's better for like the realm of psychotherapy and actually working out the details of the story. I think Zen practice is more like, let's just be with the immediacy of the present. And then maybe the story, while we're doing that, the story, it's not like it goes away, but it loses its juice. It's like, oh yeah, that's just a story about somebody really hurt me in the past. Like, and that is being held in the present now too. And okay, you know, okay, that's part of now. I think that's you could say is a method in, you know, that's a little more something to do than to just wash everything in nowness. Yeah. And I always like your idea of not your definition from some field, I can't remember what, but 10,000 hours of some activity is mastering it. Somewhat arbitrary number, but that's a little encouragement for Sasheen. Because if you want to master Zazen practice, Sasheen is a good way to do it quicker. Because there's more hours of it. So, yeah. Still takes a while to accumulate 10,000. But I like that number because I think it's something, I think it's, maybe some people can do it quicker, but I don't know. I don't think I can.
It goes, you know, but every day it goes.
Yeah. We just get more and more used to it. And our understanding becomes more clear, and the actual practicing of it becomes more extended. Yes, Ziggy.
I'm really loving this notion of washing the bowl in the ocean of now, and my mind started thinking about ocean and shifting that in another vocabulary for me of ocean of mercy and this idea of ocean and the salt water and the gift of tears and what washing our pain, that is kind of a gift of the physical body to deal with pain that resides in the body, and that's the gift of the ocean of tears, and it is layers of pain and the depth of in surprise of when that somatic trigger happens, and I realize, oh, that's from when I was 8. And this kind of practice helping me to connect in that now of I can bring that 8-year-old into this.
Yes.
Now, and somewhere there's a forgiveness component in this healing piece of
definitely
letting that gift of connecting that and then releasing that in it. So it's like I thought I was done with that, but apparently I was deeper, you know.
Yeah.
That bowl of something is, I thought I got that clean, I guess not.
Yeah.
I need more, I don't know.
Yeah, and we don't know, and we might even think it's clean until something new comes up. And even in, that's what one thing I love in the old Buddhist stories, because we say Buddha realized unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment, right? That's what we're celebrating this week in Rohatsu Sesshin. And that was the end of all delusion and the end of all suffering for the Buddha. But in the old sutras, they still say, years after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he was had established the Sangha and was everything was going great, Mara, you know, Mara is Buddha's assaulting past trauma, you could say, is that he pretty much dealt with mostly on this night of his great awakening. Pretty much, Mara assaulted him from all sides. That, you know, he was like drowning in breakfast cereal and dried polenta and almost couldn't find his way out. The attack of Mara. And, but he, you know, he really brought Mara into the ocean of nowness, and Mara, dissolved into the ocean of nowness. But later, years later in the Buddha's life, Mara would still come to him occasionally and have these little conversations. Like before, I think the Buddha was still working on some, you know, issues in the Sangha and some teachings that he hadn't given yet, but he was getting pretty old. But he knew he still had a few more things to do in that present lifetime. So Mara came and said, You've done well. You know, the Sangha is established and you've given a lot of great teachings, so you can go now. You can die. That was one of the things that Mara came and said later in Buddha's life. And Buddha said, actually, not yet, Mara. I know it's coming, but not yet. You can go now. I have some more things to do first. So we have stories like that in the old sutras that I think are nice because they imply that even for the Buddha, all the work is not necessarily done. And I love your image of the ocean of tears, that of course the ocean is salty. And the Buddha said one time to the assembly, he said, each of you in all your many lifetimes, if you add them all up, the tears you have cried would fill more than all the oceans of the world. Therefore, I think that was a kind of a pep talk too, right? It's like, you've done this painful suffering thing for a very long time, way longer than this little suffering life. So now, in this life, you have an opportunity to wash these tears in the ocean of tears. The ocean of nowness that's salty with everyone's tears. So the pure water holds all its salt, completely like mixed with the salt, inseparable. And yet it's purifying the tears. Ocean of mercy. Well, it's about time to stop and work on our mastery hours for the next week. Yeah.
Many credits
yeah.
Per.
I assume everyone's keeping track. So the verse that celebrates the story of Jiaozhou's wash your bowl. The verse says, breakfast over, the direction is to wash the bowl. Suddenly, the mind ground meets itself. And right now, you arriving people at the temple, having had your fill, you are now satisfied. But have you realized enlightenment there or not? It's a little bit like what Richard's saying. And then one comment at the end, on have you realized the way in this bowl washing or not? A comment is, peace is originally the accomplishment of the general of the army, but the general is actually not allowed to see the peace that he has accomplished. Oh well. Would you rather be the village that will now not be attacked by the opposing army and can just live in peace, and you didn't even know that they were going to attack in the first place? You're just peaceful. Or would you rather be the general of the army who comes home all kind of beat up and worn out, having done the hard work to protect that village, but doesn't get to know that the peace of that village because they got to go on and protect the next village. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.